Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, director of the OIES, to discuss the key messages that came from his recent paper after the initial oil rebound, What Next for the Market Fundamentals and Prices, that Bassam co-authored with Andreas Economou, who's a senior research fellow at the OIES and was published on the 2nd of September 2020. Bassam, great to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Now, back in May, you and Andreas wrote a paper in which you argued that the worst of the oil crisis was already behind us. But since then, the price recovery had stalled. So what's going on with oil prices?
The Brent price got stuck in a very narrow range of $44 to $45 for most of July and August. And although uncertainty, especially on the demand side, is still very high, volatility was exceptionally low. Recently, the oil price broke out from this range and Brent traded below $40 for a few days. A key reason has been the halt in demand recovery, particularly in the US, but also in many parts of the world, as governments reimposed localized restrictions due to the resurgence of the virus, which led many to revise their demand numbers and their views on the pace of recovery. Also, Chinese imports have played a key role in equilibrating the market. But there are concerns that the increase in imports has not been matched by increase in China's domestic demand. And as a result, crude and product stocks have been building. And this means that China may have overbought and its imports will ease from here. Also, a key factor that has kept prices supported has been the high compliance by OPEC Plus. However, by United Arab Emirates, a core Gulf exporter producing above their quotas, this created doubts about OPEC Plus momentum looking forward. Though I believe that this issue will be resolved and UAE compliance will improve and the country will compensate for overproduction in the previous month. But today, which by the way is September 17, prices have recovered to over $41 per barrel on the back of good macro data from China and the fall of crude inventories in the US. To me, this reflects the fact that the price recovery in the last few months has been driven by improved market fundamentals, and therefore the current 40 to 45 price range is supported, of course, unless there is a massive deterioration in demand, which I currently don't see. But at the same time, the market seems not yet ready to move to a higher price range. As I just mentioned, the initial rebound in demand seems now to have slowed or even stalled in many parts of the world. Also, output reductions have reached a peak in June as Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Kuwait ended their extra supply cuts, and OPEC Plus started easing their cuts from August. Plus, some of the shut-in production in North America started making its way back to the market in response to higher prices. But in addition to this demand and supply dynamics, we also need to remember that the existing buffers in the form of high OPEC spare capacity and the large buildup of crude and product stocks over the past few months, particularly diesel stocks, constitute additional caps on the oil price.
So in fact, there's quite a lot going on. But one of the specific points I noticed was you mentioned the recovery in oil demand has stalled. So, you know, where do you see demand going from here then, Bassam?
Well, the oil demand has gone through various stages since the start of the year and has been really the main driver of oil prices. It's important to remember that the sharp price decline that we saw back in March and April was mainly caused by the massive decline in demand. For 2020, we estimate the annual contraction in demand to reach around 8 million barrels per day, which is a massive number. Of course, the breakup of the OPEC Plus agreement in March also played a role in accelerating the price fall. But in essence, this is a demand-driven crisis, and therefore the recovery will be shaped by what happens to demand. Now, as lockdowns started easing in May, the initial recovery in oil demand took what we call a V-shape, and this helped restore some of the previous losses. But since July, the demand rebound seems to have come to a sudden halt, as concerns about the second wave resulted in restrictions and localized lockdowns. This reflects the fact that this recovery is far from linear and most likely will go through multiple stages. And in our paper, we give the example of U.S. gasoline demand. So after a year-on-year decline of around 4 million barrels per day in the month of April, the year-on-year decline is to around 900,000 barrels per day. So this represents the V-shaped stage of the recovery. But since July, the year-on-year decline remained at that level. And this represents, in a way, the straight or horizontal line-shaped stage of the recovery. Now, this example can be extended to other contexts, such as India, but not China, because the dynamics in China have been different.
Yeah, again, but I'm just surprised that this has not caused, you know, all these this growth in demand and all this volatility you talk about has not caused the oil price to break out one way or another. Isn't that surprising?
It is actually, and it's amazing in a way. As you say, this has not impacted the price level, and I believe that this is because there are opposing factors that are putting pressure on the oil price. But we did see some weakness in the physical indicators. For instance, we have Brent and Dubai turn from backwardation to contango, and crude differentials such as Urals and Bunny Light switch from trading at a premium to their benchmarks to trading at discount. So in a way, this has been reflected in the spreads much more than the price level.
Yeah. But in your paper, you've mentioned that oil demand, you know, has gone through various stages. So why don't we look ahead and ask what the next stage is for oil demand?
I think the key question currently confronting the market is the time that it will take, or even whether oil demand will reach its pre-virus level. There is a growing consensus that the next stage of the recovery towards the pre-virus level may turn out to be slower than originally expected. And this applies even for gasoline, which has performed strongly in the initial rebound stage. The other question is that even if the world reaches its pre-virus level of consumption, many are of the view that COVID-19 has profoundly changed consumers' behavior and accelerated the pace of the energy transition away from fossil fuels, and that this will cause demand to shift to a slower growth path. I think on this question, the jury is still out there. I believe it's still too early to tell.
But I'm interested by your expression, the jury is still out there. Are you not convinced that COVID-19 has resulted in some structural shifts? Because that's what you're actually insinuating in what you're saying.
Well, the picture is still cloudy. For instance, there is strong belief that oil consumption related to mobility will fall sharply as more people decide to work from home. But at the same time, the pandemic could result in a drop in the use of public transport and a preference for more private passenger vehicles. People could also avoid planes in favor of cars when possible. Also, it's true that there may be a change in people's purchasing habits, for instance, through digital platforms, but the reductions in shopping trips could be offset by higher delivery truck miles. So while COVID-19 may have accelerated the shifts in consumers' behavior, it's still early to tell how durable these changes will be and whether the new work and driving habits on their own will result in a massive reduction in oil demand. And here, I think policy is key, as governments could choose to enforce these changes in consumer behavior and go for green recovery initiatives, for instance, by accelerating the electrification of the vehicle fleet or adopting hydrogen in trucking.
So you think that the stimulus measures will actually work in accelerating the energy transition potentially, then, Bassam?
Well, history shows that factors such as scale, legacy assets, and path dependency imply that the change in the energy mix is slow. But I believe this transition is unique in that it tries to deal with the global problem of climate change and air pollution, and that it will be driven by government policy. It's true that stimulus packages will be directed more towards greener projects, for instance, compared to the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. But it's also true that the environment has become more challenging for many players. For instance, many energy companies have embarked on massive cuts in spending, and many investments have been delayed or shelved altogether. We also know that some supply chains have been interrupted. Also, it's quite important to remember that COVID-19 has hit households very hard, particularly those in low-income brackets, and therefore governments will be reluctant to shift the cost of decarbonization to consumers. And although governments have increased their debt ratios to stimulate the economy, concerns about fiscal imprudence may result in shifts in policy that could eventually weaken the stimulus. And I think one of the key things that COVID-19 has shown is the weakness of existing frameworks for global cooperation and coordination. So in my view, the stimulus measures should first and foremost be growth promoting and be implemented as early as possible. Some projects such as investment in more efficient buildings can achieve both targets of promoting green policies and stimulating the economy. But this dual target cannot be achieved for all types of investments or projects. So for all of this reason, I would argue that it's still early to reach definitive conclusions about oil demand trajectories. To put it bluntly, David, no one knows.
Well, you said that, Bassam, not me. But given all these uncertainties on the demand side, I expect the question our listeners would really like to hear the answer to is, you know, what is keeping the oil price supported?
Well, that's a very good question, David. The wide uncertainty surrounding demand implies that the role of the supply side in supporting the oil price becomes even more important in this current stage of the cycle. In this regard, the historic OPEC Plus agreement back in April has been the key factor shaping the supply side. The breakup of the OPEC Plus agreement in March did result in a sharp fall in the oil price, but this had the effect of focusing the minds of the world's largest producers. And unlike the 1997, 1998, and the 2014, 2016 price cycles, when it took many months for the producers to reach an agreement, a producer response was much faster during this cycle. And of course, the sharp reduction in U.S. shale output also played a key role in rebalancing the supply side of the market.
But surely, you know, the interesting thing about that, of course, were the large cuts you referred to. Don't such large cuts mean compliance was expected to be low?
Well, the historic size of the cut would not have had its desired impact on prices without the high compliance shown by OPEC Plus.
Okay.
And I would argue that the high OPEC Plus compliance has been the key feature of the recovery phase so far. And this is despite, as you say, the large size of the cut, the large number of producers under the umbrella of OPEC Plus, and the increasing difficulties in verifying the compliance of individual producers. What is remarkable is that the compliance has been high, even excluding losses due to geopolitical disruptions. It's important here to remember that Venezuela, Iran, and Libya have all been excluded from the OPEC Plus agreement. And this high compliance is also happening without Saudi Arabia cutting above its quota and compensating for the rest of OPEC Plus non-compliance, like what used to happen previously. And this, in a way, explains the recent emphasis by some producers, particularly Saudi Arabia, on the importance of achieving full compliance and introducing a new compensation regime for those OPEC Plus members who have been producing above their quotas between May and July to compensate for those overproduction in the months of August and September.
So do you think the OPEC Plus compensation regime you referred to has actually worked?
Well, yes, if implemented. Actually, in the paper, our results show that if the compensation regime is fully implemented during the months of August and September, prices will be higher compared to a scenario in which there is no compensation. But I think the compensation regime has also a signaling role. It sends a credible signal about OPEC Plus' willingness and ability to navigate through this shock. Without such credibility, I think the oil price would have fallen under the renewed demand pressure. It's also used as a tool to ensure compliance. I think that's a very key point. Even if not all producers compensate, it puts additional pressure on non-compliers, which in a way enhances the credibility of the OPEC Plus signal.
But what about the enforceability? You know, then has that actually worked? You know, are there new systems and processes in place this time around?
Oh, God, this is such a thorny issue, David. And, you know, because as you know, OPEC has no formal enforcement mechanism to ensure compliance. I think all producers agree that in the face of excess supplies, reliance on price mechanisms to correct the market imbalance will take a long time. And that cooperation between producers to restrict supplies is the most effective way to rebalance the market and reverse the price decline. I think even the US and President Trump understood this during this cycle. But the disagreements usually arise over which countries should shoulder the burden of the cut. Non-OPEC countries would leave it to OPEC to implement the cuts, and many within OPEC would like to leave it to Saudi Arabia to cut. But really, no one should realistically expect Saudi Arabia to balance the market on its own. In 1985, Saudi Arabia attempted to defend the market price on its own, and this resulted in a huge loss of market share, which proved to be very costly for Saudi Arabia. And I believe that this still shapes their oil policy until today. Since then, through public announcement and its action, Saudi Arabia has insisted on the principle of collective cuts. Also, with the share of OPEC declining over time, there was emphasis that additional producers need to join the output cut agreements. And therefore, this principle of collective cuts did not only apply to OPEC, but also to non-OPEC, particularly to big producers such as Russia. And David, this has really been the main motivation behind the creation of the OPEC Plus. And actually, if you look at the G20 energy ministers, which back in April also agreed to take corrective measures within the umbrella of the G20, shows that there is recognition of the world's three largest suppliers, that is US, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, that in the face of a severe shock, it's in their mutual interest to act strategically and cooperate.
But so listening to you, it sounds to me that there has been quite a change in Saudi behavior during this cycle. Is that correct?
In terms of core principles, I don't see much change. But in terms of approach, yes, I do. The new Saudi oil minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, reinforced the principle of collective cuts and the importance of full compliance. There were two trends, actually, that were becoming clear within the kingdom's oil policy decision-making, and even before COVID-19 spreading. The first was a more proactive approach for managing the market. The second one was lower tolerance for producers' non-compliance with the agreed quotas. And these two trends were highly visible as early as OPEC meeting in December 2019. But it's also throughout. In the last GMMC meeting of the OPEC Plus, by the way, GMMC stands for the Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee, the Saudi oil minister made the three C's as core of his speech. The three C's are cut, comply, and compensate. And the breakup of the OPEC Plus agreement in March showed that without a collective action on cuts, Saudi Arabia is willing to shift oil policy until players are ready to enter into an agreement. Once the agreement has been reached, Saudi Arabia offered to make additional cuts to encourage other OPEC Plus participants to comply, but this additional cut was limited in duration to 1 month, and in July, Saudi Arabia restored its output to the agreed quota, signaling that these additional measures should not be considered as permanent or be counted on to balance the market. I also think the monthly meetings of the GMMC and the introduction of the compensation schemes are additional signals of the importance that Saudi Arabia attached to compliance and its determination to lead on this front.
What about the possibility of the return of some of the disrupted oil supplies from Iran, Venezuela, and Libya? Is that a threat that could suddenly kind of find supplies increasing more?
We are quite pessimistic on Venezuela and Iran returning anytime soon. But even on Libya, if it returns, we don't believe that it's going to return quickly to its pre-disruption level. And I think this is what's going to be a fundamental feature from the past, because in the past, every time Libya came back to the market, it reached above 1 million barrels per day fairly quickly. We don't believe this is going to happen.
Really, we've only briefly talked about kind of the big elephant in the room, and that is, of course, US shale. Now, has that been an important part of this cycle?
Absolutely. Shale is a key factor shaping market outcomes today and it will continue in the future. Unlike the 2014-2016 cycle, which came at the back of a sustained period of Brent prices above $100 per barrel, the financial position of oil shale players is relatively weaker, and therefore the supply contractions and shut-ins have been deeper and faster in this cycle. Following the sharp contractions in U.S. shale production in May and June, some of the output losses is expected to be restored as shut-in wells come back into production. This is expected. But as in the case of demand, the second stage towards full recovery to 2019 production levels may prove to be a very lengthy process. Rig activity has fallen, and so has the numbers of wells completed, and no shale play has been spared, including the Permian. With access to external finance restricted and cash flow under severe pressure, expectations that U.S. shale will turn around quickly and sharply are misplaced in my view. Our model actually shows that even by the end of 2022, U.S. shale will not have reached its previous peak in November 2019.
So, well, that's fascinating, Bassoon, but talking with some about the kind of OPEC situation, it strikes me that it's going to face some really hard choices. So, you know, what are these and how could they react, do you think?
Yes, indeed. And in our paper, we consider a few situations, and particularly two demand scenarios. One in which oil demand recovers to its pre-virus level by mid-2021, and one in which this does not occur until the end of 2022. In the stronger demand scenario, OPEC Plus faces the decision as to whether to ease the cut to put a cap on the oil price or maintain the cut to accelerate the drawdown inventories. That decision will be shaped by views on non-OPEC supply and particularly U.S. shale response to higher oil prices. Now, in the alternative scenario of weaker oil demand recovery, the challenges facing OPEC Plus will amplify as it will have to face the decision as to whether deepen the current cut, extend the cuts beyond December 2020, or enter the final stage of the OPEC Plus agreement. Each of these decisions has its own challenges, and OPEC Plus again will find itself faced with tough choices and trying to balance the various trade-offs. Of those trade-offs, I think whether to ease the cuts and ensure compliance or deepen the cut and risk lower compliance will be the key determinants of OPEC Plus policy looking forward. Also, in this scenario of weaker demand recovery, OPEC Plus faced the challenge whether to exit the deal or extend it beyond April 2022.
As you know, this is the difficult question, of course, Bassoon. This is the last question of the podcast. You know, I always like to end by trying to look forward, and I expect what our listeners would like to understand is where you see oil prices moving from here and what are the key dynamics that they should look out for to identify the direction that prices could move. Do you know, can you give a view on this?
Well, David, this will depend on the pace of demand recovery and OPEC Plus responses. I believe these two factors will determine in which direction and how fast the oil price will break away from the current range. In our paper, we expect the breakout to occur in the fourth quarter, but it will be gradual and limited on the upside. I personally believe the market seems more prepared to move to a higher rather than to a lower price range and has been waiting for some positive signals on the demand side, particularly from the US and India. A key reason for this upward bias is that there is a belief that total lockdowns similar to what we have seen in March and April are not likely, and therefore demand will recover even though at a slower pace. In the background, the view that the oil industry cannot increase investment and bring new supplies in this price environment, and that it will take time for U.S. shale output to recover to its previous peak, are also gaining traction. But I believe a key premise underlying this, what I describe as the upward bias, is that OPEC Plus cohesiveness and high compliance will be maintained. And I believe this represents a fundamental shift from the previous cycles.
Well, Bassam, thank you. You know, thank you very much for your time. Again, I've really enjoyed our discussion today on the oil market and the views. And one thing is clear, it's certainly very changing. We've got to keep an eye on it. And certainly this podcast builds upon the messages from your recently published paper, After the Initial Oil Rebound, What Next for the Market Fundamentals and Price. And I hope you, the listeners, have enjoyed the podcast. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.